Hello, I'm Luke Broadwater, and I am a State House reporter at the Baltimore Sun.
And I'm Malia Cromer, pollster and political science professor at Goucher College. And this is Roughly Speaking, Government Edition, a Baltimore Sun podcast where each week during legislative session, we take a closer look at the policy, people, and places that shape our state government.
This week, we're going to talk with Delegate Kathy Shalega, who is a Republican who represents Maryland's 7th District, which is in Baltimore and Harford County. She's also the minority whip of the House of Delegates.
Among other things, we'll get to know Delegate Shalega and her district a little better and get her views on the Republican legislative agenda and that robocall. But first, let's circle back and take a quick look at the Baltimore Sun reporting during the first week of legislative session. It's been a busy week. Luke, what are the highlights?
Well, I'm not sure if this is a highlight, but it's a very, very serious situation concerning Senate President Mike Miller. Obviously, Senate President Mike Miller is a giant in Maryland politics. He's been the Senate President for 33 years, and he announced last Thursday that he is undergoing treatment for prostate cancer. My colleague Pamela Wood, a fellow State House reporter, was in the Senate chambers for that announcement, and here's what she had to say about the mood in the room.
So the General Assembly started on the first day with a lot of high energy, a lot of excitement, everybody coming back to work. But the second day, the Senate was kind of full of anticipation, kind of somber, maybe a little bit of dread, because President Miller had said on the first day, unprompted, that he would have an announcement about his health. And hours later, it was revealed that he was going to say he had prostate cancer. So everybody knew coming in that that's what they were going to find out from the Senate president. And there were a whole lot more people in the chamber than you normally would get on day two of the Senate, when very little of consequence normally happens. Some of his former chiefs of staff were there. Some former senators were there. There were more journalists than normal. And we all kind of waited for President Miller to give the news about his prostate cancer. And right from the start, he was a little teary. He introduced the guest minister for the day, who gave the prayer, a Catholic priest, and he kind of teared up and said, "Oh, I'm already not off to a good start." And he didn't actually address it directly. What President Miller did was pass out a letter to senators and to the journalists, and the letter explained his cancer diagnosis. And he said, "Well, here's the information, and this is a new thing, and I don't want this to be about me. I want everything to be about the Senate. I don't want the focus on me." And he never actually said the word cancer directly, but it was all laid out in the written statement.
What was the reaction from the room? What were people's faces like?
Everybody was very serious. Everybody understands the gravity. Anytime someone's diagnosed with cancer, I'm certain everybody in the room has dealt with this in their personal life. And, you know, the senators across the board, Republicans and Democrats, really have a lot of great respect for Mike Miller and how he leads his chamber, even those who often disagree with him. So they really took this very seriously. It was very quiet, but there were some light moments. Senator Miller talked about having to switch his razor and looking for to see how much hair he has left. And he kind of chuckled and got a few moments of levity, even given the serious situation.
And so, you know, as we were reporting the story, we learned that this is advanced cancer. It's metastasized throughout his body. What does the research show about his chances to beat this?
So, yeah, Senator Miller has prostate cancer. And most of the time when prostate cancer is actually found, it's localized within the prostate, and the survival rate is very high. In a smaller percentage of cases, like President Miller's case, it's metastasized. It's spread somewhere else. We're told it's advanced. We don't know exactly how much it's spread. But in those cases, the five-year survival rate is about 29 or 30%, according to an oncologist I spoke with. So that's not, great odds. But certainly, Miller said he's going to He's going to fight it. He's getting medication. He's getting chemo. And a lot of his supporters are believe that he will use his tenacity that he has shown in politics in fighting the cancer.
Yeah, on just a day earlier when he was walking with the cane, he held the cane up and brandished it about and said he was going to use it to beat the Hogan administration with. So he has not lost his sense of fire. What does this mean going forward for the General Assembly? How will things be different now that this diagnosis is known?
Well, practically speaking, we expect that President Miller will not be in Annapolis 100% of the time. He's undergoing treatment at Johns Hopkins Hospital. He has to have chemotherapy on the third day of session, Friday. He was up at Hopkins getting treatment, and so he was not there to preside over the floor of the Senate. Those duties were handled by Senator Kathy Klausmeier of Baltimore County. She's the president pro tem, which basically means she's the substitute for the Senate president. So we will see Senator Klausmeier more leading the floor sessions. The Senate president doesn't sit on any committees, any of the standing committees. So, you know, he won't be missing from those. I imagine even when he's not here, if he's at the hospital or if he's at home recovering from chemo and misses some days here and there, I have a feeling he's still going to have his finger on the pulse of things and be calling people and calling the shots, even if he's not president.
And despite his very serious diagnosis, I think it should be noted that Senate President Miller had not lost his sense of humor. And even though he knew he had been diagnosed with a very serious form of cancer, still on the opening day of session, he had quite a bit of fun with his rival and nemesis, Peter Francho. The Senate President Miller singled out the controller several times for ridicule. Here he is mocking Francho's hair.
With the next guy is like in his fifth coloring of hair. Where I was 15 years ago, the Washington Post did my five different colorings of hair before I finally go away. 3 years from his is going to be all white too. The comptroller, Peter Francho, please. Comptroller, Peter Francho.
And here is Senate President Miller implying that Francho is really a Republican.
Comptroller, you can be excused anytime you want to. I see you waving to all your friends, guests. I read somewhere you got 3,000 more votes than the governor. Oh my goodness, that's unbelievable. The governor's shaking his boots right now. Some, you know, when you're both running against each other in the primary for U.S. Senate, we'll find out who does have the votes, okay? All right.
And here he is making it clear, in case there was any doubt, that he and Francho are not, in fact, friends.
Again, the comptroller's standing tall right here. He's trying to make a statement. Trying to make a statement here of some sort. I'm not sure. I know. He was at a Democratic Party meeting the other day, and he told people there, without me being there, that he was my best friend. You know what I mean? So now he's trying to demonstrate that fact, but not true. Not true. All right. Anyway, anything else for the good of the order? Senate stands in adjournment. Thank you, Peter.
But Miller wasn't the only senator who had a moment of levity. Here is State Senator Bill Ferguson of Baltimore City passing off the baby senator trophy given to him by Mike Miller. The nickname given to him by Mike Miller to the new youngest member of the state Senate, Sarah Elfrith of Anne Arundel County.
8 years ago, I had the honor of joining this body, and it has been an incredible privilege. And at the time, was elected as the youngest member ever elected to Maryland to the state Senate. And it has been eight very, very long years as the youngest member of the Maryland State Senate. I thought at once that my good friend from Carroll County, but apparently just a few months away, he had me beat. I thought my seatmate, when he came over to the Senate, would take that esteemed title away from me. Unfortunately, that was not the case. Again, 3 or 4 months in that 8 long years of being the baby senator from Baltimore City. My very first week, the president, I rose to speak and assigned me the baby senator from Baltimore, and it has stuck for the last 8 years. So today, I have the esteemed honor of presenting to the youngest woman ever elected in the in the state of Maryland to the state Senate, the Maryland General Assembly's Baby Senator Award, handed over to Sarah Elfrith.
Miller's announcement wasn't the only news of the week. Two other big stories were the minimum wage and Governor Hogan's Strikeforce crime plan. Let's start with that.
Yeah, so the governor came out. He was addressing what's been a very serious concern for the citizens of Baltimore, and that is we've had more than 300 homicides for 4 years in a row. And it's people have tried many different things, but nothing seems to really be working, and we can't get the crime under control the way it was really only a mayor or two ago. And so the governor came forward with some proposals. This was really his legislative agenda, but also this strike force he talked about. Now, I think it should be noted that the strike force really is a federal operation. It is a combining of resources from a bunch of different agencies. And what Governor Hogan was really doing was adding state resources to the plan. You know, I got a call from the states, from the U.S. Attorney's Office and from the Baltimore Police Department shortly after the press conference. And they were like, hey, you know, we don't want to step on the governor's toes or anything, but Strikeforce has been going on for some months. So he's really joining in this effort. The governor also proposed enhancing Project Exile, which is taking prosecutions from state court to federal court where there are longer sentences and fewer opportunities for parole. And he also is putting forward some proposals about longer mandatory minimum sentences and also a tracking of judges and their sentencing to see which judges are tough on crime and which ones are soft on crime, in his view. So, you know, this stuff is going to be debated throughout the General Assembly session, but it's going to be a hot topic all session, which is how best to address crime, specifically crime in Baltimore.
So another big issue during legislative session will certainly be the minimum wage. And Governor Hogan was on the record this week, and he expressed some concerns about what a $15 minimum wage would do to the business community here in Maryland. It's something that's been sort of – he has talked about consistently through both his campaigns in 2014 and 2018, a real concern about small businesses here in Maryland.
Yeah, that's right. So now this is going to be an interesting question for the governor, because we have seen polling that raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour is popular in Maryland. And we all know Governor Hogan looks at the polls. That said, I think he is showing his Republican or conservative credentials here. He, you know, generally the Republican Party doesn't love the idea of raising the minimum wage. And but, you know, Senate President Miller has said a minimum wage increase will pass this year. So he's going to have a tough decision when whatever the bill is that comes out of the General Assembly makes its way to the governor's desk. Does he veto it? Does he or does he reluctantly sign it? Because, you know, he is out there already saying he doesn't love this idea of raising the minimum wage.
While he might not love it, there's certainly a ton of support among the rank-and-file population. So a new Gonzales poll came out last week. The same poll that showed that Governor Hogan had that 77% approval rating showed that Marylanders, by and large, really do support the so-called fight for 15. As a matter of fact, 61% is what Gonzales had it at among Maryland voters. It's really high among Democrats, 78% among Democrats. And as you noted before, that does not have the sort of support among Republicans. Only 30% of Republicans support it. The Gonzales poll is very consistent with what our poll has found in the past. We've asked about minimum wage on the Goucher poll several times. It's consistently high, and it's consistently really strong among Democrats, particularly progressives. And now that it seems it might make muster to get clear to the governor's desk, it'll be interesting, as you said, Luke, whether he vetoes it, whether he allows it to become law without a signature, or whether he actually becomes, I think, probably the first governor, certainly the first Republican governor in the state, in the country, to sign a minimum wage bill. So before we move on to our guest, an interesting fact. As a result of Senate President Mike Miller and Speaker Bush's absences on Friday, for the first time in Maryland history, both presiding officers in the Maryland General Assembly were women. So Kathy Klausmeier, a senator from Baltimore County, and State Delegate Adrienne Jones from Baltimore City presided over their respective chambers this past Friday. So having women preside over both chambers is a female first in Maryland, but our state certainly isn't a stranger to powerful female leadership from both sides of the political aisle. And although it's a disappointment that there aren't any women in statewide elected office in our congressional delegation, Maryland continues to rank as one of the most gender-diverse state legislatures in the country. Right now, 37% of the seats in the Maryland General Assembly are held by women, and the national average is right around 30. And today we're going to speak with the highest ranking female Republican currently serving in elected office in Maryland, Delegate Kathy Chalega, the minority whip in the House. Thanks for coming on Roughly Speaking, Delegate.
Great to be on.
Okay, so I'm going to give listeners a sort of a quick walkthrough of the electoral history in your district. You represent the 7th District. It's a multi-member district in Baltimore and Harford counties. It's heavily Republican. 66% of the vote went to Trump in 2016, 27% went to Clinton, and you've been very successful. For the first time you ran in 2010, you came in third with about 17% of the vote. But since then, you've received anywhere between 20 to 25% of that Republican primary vote. And even in 2018, when the other incumbent running lost 10% of his vote share, you still held strong with around 23% of the vote. We'll get to Delegate Impelleri in a minute. So, Delegate, tell us a little bit about that your district. How do I know that I'm in the 7th district?
So you might think gerrymandered when you think of District 7. It is the largest Baltimore area district by population. With gerrymandering, they can draw the lines to be plus or minus 5%. So many of the districts are minus 5% population, minus plus 5%. Very diverse, geographically diverse, population diversity of urban, suburban, and rural. I have a buffalo farm, dairy farms, wineries, Bordy Vineyards is in my district. And how would you know when you're in the 7th district? You probably wouldn't, because the line is squirrely. And often I'll say to people, now, what side of Sweet Air do you live on? And, you know, you may or may not live in my district.
That's great. Okay, so most legislative work that actually gets done during a legislative session is sometimes district specific. Can you point to something that you've done during your time in office that you helped your district out through the legislative process?
Sure. So I've worked with Ladue Gardens extensively. What a wonderful gem right in Baltimore, Harford County, it's right in Harford County, but school kids from all over the region go there. It's a historic, great concerts, summertime events there. And so helping make sure they have funding, the rain tax, the problem with impervious surfaces, they needed a bigger parking lot. So we help with some funding for that. Bordy Vineyards always trying to make sure, you know, they're staying in business and, working on some issues over in Middle River, the Martin State Airport's in our district. So making sure that the National Guard's located there, they have everything they need, regulatory things with the marinas, that type of thing.
Wonderful. Okay, so we have to talk about the robocall that made news last week. Maryland prosecutors have charged a top aide to Delegate Impelleri, the Republican, who also represents the 7th District with you, for making approximately 9,000 robocalls to residents in both counties in your district the day before the June 26th primary. The call suggested that you were supported by the National Center for Transgender Equality because of a vote you took last session. Now, the aide is in legal trouble because the call lacked the appropriate authority line, but I have to say it brings up a lot more issues than just running afoul of campaign finance laws. How do you see it?
It was shameful. I have to tell you, I was so disappointed. The night before the election, we're all out, busy, putting up signs. I, like, you know, everyone else on the ballot, I was out putting up signs at polling places, making sure my volunteers had literature, all the crazy things that happen the night before an election. My phone starts blowing up with people calling me, "You won't believe this robocall I just got." And, you know, the content of the call was disgraceful, and the lack of an authority line was even more so. And it is so important. I was really disappointed that Delegate Impalaria brushed it off when he spoke with the Baltimore Sun, like, that's no big deal. Of course it's a big deal. He's been in office 16 years. He is a lawmaker. He knows that people judge the call by who's paying for it. And it didn't work. I got the highest number of votes, I think, ever in my district in a primary. And voters, you know, either were appalled by the content, didn't believe the content. It, you know, was not an issue, as I had campaigned, that anyone talked about or asked about. And so I think it showed that, you know, out of touch, dirty tricks, last minute stuff just doesn't work.
So the Baltimore Sun editorial page weighed in on this issue as well. And if folks at home want to read about it, the piece is titled, "Hey, 7th District, Can We Talk About Rick Impalaria?" They go on to say, the Baltimore Sun opinion page says it's, that his actions were not only bigoted and underhanded, but double-crossing to boot. But they were, and while they did make a distinction, they have differed on you on many policy issues. They describe you as smart, dedicated, and unfailingly positive, and a deserving star in the Maryland Republican Party. And honestly, Delegate, I got to see those characteristics firsthand. You made it a point a few legislative sessions ago to make one of my female students from Goucher College feel like she had a powerful female advocate when she needed it during her legislative internship. So it's undeniable that you're a role model for young conservative women in the state. So your perspective on this really matters. So let's face it, Republican women here in Maryland and nationwide are falling behind their Democratic counterparts when it comes to elected office. Why do you think that is, and what would you like to see to have that sort of fixed?
It is very disappointing. I think a part of the reason that Republican women in general have fallen behind, let's admit it, fallen behind their Democrat counterpoints, because Republicans basically don't embrace identity politics. And, you know, I want to be valued because, not because I'm a woman, I want to be valued because I work hard and you agree with me on my philosophy of government. That being said, this year my project is to do better, make sure that Republican women know there's a place for them to go for resources. The Democrats have done an amazing job with Emerge. It's a national program. The state chapter has just really done a fantastic job. And so I'm encouraged by the work they've done to say, you know, I need to do the same thing. And I look at my daughter-in-laws. I have two sons, married wonderful women. They're in their 30s, the two little granddaughters. You know, I'm in this for the future of them. I want women to say, you know what? I agree with Kathy Shalega. You know, my values mirror hers. I'm center-right. I'm center-center-right. And, you know, it's not that I don't love my Democrat women colleagues, but philosophy of government matters. And so I really want to work hard to represent those women and put a kind female face on the things we believe in.
And so I think this sentiment is also echoed by the Republican Party in Maryland. In a recent interview with the Baltimore Sun, Dirk Hare, your chairman, you know, expressed the need for the Maryland GOP to sort of embrace having more female and more female candidates, as well as a sort of diverse set of candidates. And I think there's a point. I would have to ask you this: like, at what point does it stop being identity politics, Republican Party, and just start being smart politics?
I can't agree with you more. And that's the case I'm making. And, you know, going back, Ellen Sauerbrey, You know, anybody over 40 knows who she is. But under 40, they're like, who are you talking about? I call her my dear fairy godmother, just such a role model. And Helen Bentley, Connie Morella. You know, we look at these women, Marjorie Holt, that did serve before us, that were great role models for us. And it's one of the reasons I did run for Senate 2 years ago, was I looked at that and I said, hey, my generation, I'm in my 50s, you know, us girls need to step up and take the baton from Ellen and, you know, Helen, who's departed, but Connie and others who did a great job representing us. And it's a shame that in the congressional delegation, Democrat or Republican, we don't have any women in Washington. In such a wonderful, diverse state, it's a shame.
Okay, well, I'm going to toss it over to Luke, and he's going to ask you some questions about sort of what's on the Republican agenda for this legislative session.
Delegate, thanks so much for being here. We've heard so much about the Democrats' agenda this session, everything from legalizing marijuana to increasing the minimum wage to $15. What should we expect from the Republicans in Annapolis?
So the House Republican Caucus is putting together a legislative agenda. We're going to launch it next week. This week is, you know, last week we were sworn in. It was wonderful seeing all those new faces. This week on Wednesday, we have the historic inauguration of Larry Hogan, second Republican reelected in the over 200 year history of our wonderful state. So we'll be focused on that and looking optimistically towards the future. And the following week, we're going to release our legislative priorities, which will include redistricting. There are 141 delegates. Some are in three-member districts, some are in two-member, some are in one-member. I think it violates the one-man, one-vote. For instance, people who live in my district, I have three delegates that represent District 7. Right adjacent to me is Susan McComas. She's a one-delegate district. Her citizens get one vote on the House floor and one vote in committee. My citizens get three votes in committee, three votes on the House floor. It just doesn't, it's not right that we're not equally sharing representation. So we have a bill to create single-member districts, 141 of them, and we think that's important that citizens, that legislators, politicians don't pick their voters, but voters get to pick their politicians. So we'll be doing that. We're looking at tax increase that's coming down from the federal tax. We know in February, March, when citizens, taxpayers fill out their tax returns, they're going to be shocked. They're going to say, why do I owe more state taxes? I'm getting money back on the federal level. We need to fix that. And we're focused on crime in Baltimore City. Those are three of our initiatives. We'll have a couple more, but those we know people are really, really concerned about.
And what specifically do you want to do with crime in Baltimore? I saw you recently had comments about crime spilling over into the county.
Oh, my gosh. Well, my district borders the city, and most of my, a vast number of people who live in District 7 either lived in the city and moved out or have family that still live in the city. My son and his wife live in the city. You know, we care deeply about what goes on in the city, not just for the folks that live in the city, but we're also seeing crime spill out into the county. I live in Perry Hall. We had a gas station robbed twice, an ATM, and then just last week, another gas station robbed. We had the horrible killing of Amy Caprio, our Baltimore County police officer, that was killed by Baltimore City youth that should have been in school. So this is an issue we all care about. We care about our city. And Governor Hogan must have been reading our mind. He put a bill in last week. He had introduced an initiative on judicial transparency. We think that's important. We think one of the problems is the judges and the prosecutors just aren't locking up the bad guys. And these folks that are caught doing these crimes have rap sheets a mile long. It's not acceptable. We believe that if you do the crime, I think that Michael Harrison, the guy applying for the Baltimore City Police Chief, said it well. He said, if you do the crime, you should do the time.
And obviously, you ran for U.S. Senate. Do you have any further ambitions to run for anything else in the future?
Well, Luke, my husband would say, oh, dear Lord, please let her say no. See, running for office is just 24/7 nonstop. You feel like your life's under a microscope and you're worried what people are going to say about you. And, you know, my dear husband, you know, he takes it personally when people criticize me, which is very sweet. And I think spouses may have a harder time with that than the actual candidate. But, you know, look, we have redistricting coming up with the Supreme Court mandating District 6. I think we're going to see that redistricted. And then in 2020, we'll have a census, new maps in 22. You know, it's something I would look at. I love my job in the House. I love being the whip. I love working with our House Republican caucus. Nick Kipke's a wonderful leader, a great man. I love working with Speaker Bush and my colleagues in the House. So right now I'm happy there and I just want to do the very best job I can.
Do you really ride that motorcycle?
I do. I do. I put the battery tender on it just 2 weeks ago. I can't wait till it warms up.
Okay. Cool. Well, thanks so much for coming on.
All right. Thanks so much.
Okay. That's all we have for this week on Roughly Speaking, Government Edition. Well, we'll be back next week for your enjoyment until the adjournment.
If you like what you heard, please find us and subscribe via anywhere podcasts are found. And while times change, the need for quality journalism doesn't. So please consider a subscription to the Baltimore Sun, which you can get by going to www.baltimoresun.com. Thanks and see you next week.